The following podcast is brought to you by Fifth Third Bank.
My name is Roland Prevost, and I'll be your moderator today. I would like to introduce your presenters for today. These are our experts. Sean Brady is a Senior Manager of Identity Protection and Verification Product Marketing with RSA. Mr. Brady is a global expert on issues and mitigation strategies related to online fraud, including advanced crimeware and attack vectors, the underground fraud economy and supply chain, and the latest trends. He's been quoted in dozens of news outlets, including the BBC, New York Times, Washington Post, Forbes, and all major trade outlets. Mr. Brady has more than 9 years of experience in the online fraud and security industry in various roles, working with many of the world's largest financial service providers. At RSA, Mr. Brady is responsible for the global go-to-market strategy for RSA's external threats and e-commerce authentication product line. Prior to joining RSA, Mr. Brady was product manager for Whale Communications, a leading remote access provider acquired by Microsoft in 2006. Lance Murray is vice president and director of security and risk services for Fifth Third Bank. In this role, Mr. Murray leads five critical functions for the bank, including information security, IT risk, business continuity management, IT enterprise management, and IT governance. Mr. Murray joined Fifth Third Bank in September 2003 as the head of Information Technologies Audit Team. In this role, he was responsible for developing and executing the audit plans for the Information Technology, Fifth Third Processing Services, and Corporate Treasury Management lines of business. Prior to joining Fifth Third Bank, Mr. Murray served as a senior manager in Ernst & Young's Technology Security and Risk Services practice. Pat Alcox is Vice President and Payable Solution Manager with Fifth Third Bank. In this role, Mr. Alcox is responsible for business line profitability and growth, business and market strategy, and product development for Fifth Third Bank's core treasury management products. Prior to serving in his current role, Mr. Alcox held several executive-level positions at Fifth Third, including Product Line Manager for Business Banking and Director of EFT Product Management. Before joining Fifth Third, he worked for J.P. Morgan Chase, SunTrust Bank, and Bank One in a number of strategic areas. Today you will increase your understanding of payment fraud and learn about the latest trends in online cybercrime. Then you will learn about some things that you can do to protect your organization. And finally, you will get answers to the questions that you've asked during the session using the Q&A menu at the top of your live meeting screen. Now, Pat Alcox will introduce four important types of payment fraud. Pat?
Thanks, Roland. And thank you for everyone for attending today's session. I know this is an investment of your time, and I really appreciate you all being here today. I'm hopeful that some of the things that we discussed today will help you further protect your company's assets by implementing some of the processes that you hear about, the procedures, and even some of the technologies as well. You know, when you think of payment fraud, what frequently comes to mind is check. And this is clearly makes sense because check fraud represents almost 91% of all payment fraud types. But what if I could tell you that I could help you increase your revenues by 7% by focusing on fraud? I'm sure this would greatly gain your attention. It has been estimated that companies lose approximately 7% of their annual revenues from fraud alone. Yet while check fraud encompasses the vast majority of fraudulent dollars, electronic fraud such as ACH and wire are becoming one of the fastest growing types of fraud and really require financial institutions and companies like yourself to mutually work together really to combat this growing problem. So let's learn a little bit more about cybercrime trends. What I'd like to do now is turn this over to Sean Brady. Sean?
Thanks, Pat, and welcome everybody. What I'm hoping to do today is to actually provide you some information that you can take away on not only where sort of RSA sees fraud and what some of the current statistics are, but really some trends and where we think everything's going as we continue through 2010 and really start to look out to 2011. The goal being that you can take this information and take it back and start to make some decisions about your own strategies, which I'm sure my friends over at Fifth Third will have some additional information on. But before we go in, RSA ran a consumer survey, basically at the very end of last year, sort of on what consumer sensibilities are towards online threats. Has your organization ever been a victim of online payment fraud? We found in our survey that consumers are overwhelmingly aware of the threats which are actually out there these days. So almost 80% were aware of phishing attacks, more than 80% were aware of Trojans, and even greater volumes we're aware of viruses. So you yourself recognize that you feel that your organizations have been victims of payment threats, and consumers generally are very, very aware of the threats. How concerned are you about Trojans and spyware being installed on your computer? We found that 93% of respondents were very concerned about Trojans and spyware being installed on your computer. The audience we have today is probably actually even more concerned, and I think that's excellent. So we see so far that there's a great deal of awareness about the risk of threats. There is a great deal of concern about Trojans and spyware. But what may be lacking so far, what's maybe some of the information which may be very helpful to you, is to understand where these threats are actually coming from and where they're going. So in terms of where they're coming from, it's important to understand that there is really this business, this full-fledged business that backs up fraudsters. The days of an individual fraudster or an individual group of fraudsters committing all of the parts of cybercrime themselves are long past us. These days we have what we call a cybercrime supply chain, meaning there are individuals who each fulfill pieces of the whole cybercrime process, and they all work together making money and profit in their own ways, and the end goal or the end result is still the same. It's just individual contributors. There are now people who have found they can make more money just writing the malicious attacks, writing the software, and then selling the software. They'll even sell it with maintenance and SLA agreements. There are individuals who provide hosting services, who do delivery, who provide mules or recruit mules, who handle the drops, who handle cash out. There's all these multiple pieces of the puzzle that really form an end-to-end supply chain. And what ends up happening is it's only the person who ultimately cashes out that ends up sharing most of the risk from a legal perspective. So all of these groups, again, work together, and there's all these individuals communicating out there. And the way or the place that they communicate is in underground forums. What you're looking at here is a screenshot of an underground forum. It's not important to understand the text. It's just to know that you have this supply chain, and then there's this forum where they can engage in business with each other, and they'll buy, sell, market to each other. Many of these sites may have banner ads where they literally will advertise their wares to each other. And so this is where they all gather to share the information and ultimately build out that supply chain that we reference. So with that supply chain and with that infrastructure they have in place, where are they actually going with the trends? We've been monitoring through the year approximately 5 different trends, but we're really shaping this as, we call it, 2 different conversations. The first conversation that we're having is the traditional attacks that we've always been aware of. So we saw earlier that there are high degrees of awareness of phishing attacks or Trojan attacks that ultimately result in some form of payment fraud. So the question is, where are these attacks going? Are they going away or are they continuing to evolve? Well, the answer really is that they're continuing to evolve. So the first thing, we all know phishing. Phishing's been around since approximately 2004-3 when it really debuted out of the UK. And despite some news in the media saying, oh, phishing's on the decline, the reality is that the number of sites, of unique sites trying to do phishing and steal information that way, actually continues to increase as a steady drumbeat year over year. So you can see the curve there that RSA monitors, and we're seeing additional growth now in 2010. So phishing is not only not going away, it's continuing to increase. But one of the areas that's really driving phishing is not so much financial services anymore, but it's things outside of financial services. Because what the fraudsters have discovered and what they now well understand is you can target other properties and build out a lot of what you need and really build out a business for yourself as part of that cybercrime supply chain that fulfills your own goals and still can, at the end of the day, contribute to selling information and stealing money. Social networks are a perfect example today. A stolen account to a social network is one of the best distribution lists possible that fraudsters can create. Think about that. If you get an email from someone who has friended you on a social network and they are claiming some need, your level of trust of that is going to be incrementally higher than if you just saw it from a stranger or one of the 419 scams which come out of Africa. An interesting scam that came out of the recent Icelandic volcano activity was people started launching scams through Facebook, using hijacked Facebook accounts, basically saying something along the lines of, help, I'm stuck at Heathrow in London, or I'm stuck at this European airport because of the volcano, I'm out of money, I don't have access, can you help me out? And that became, again, a scam that was launched exploiting things like the social networks. Furthermore, so as phishing continues to grow, it's also continuing to really actively adopt new channels. We saw attacks via the voice channel, via a phone channel, what we call vishing, or via an SMS channel, what we call smishing. We saw those attacks really sort of get off the ground in 2009, and they've definitely picked up and accelerated their pace in 2010. Basically, what this is you can get a phone call, or you can get even more commonly a text saying, please call us back at this information, or even worse, please text us back personal information to this number. We need to confirm something. The people that fall for these attacks are typically not the individuals who are participating on the phone today, because we have a higher level of awareness. The people who fall for these attacks are the same people that fall for phishing attacks. The less aware, the more trusting, the less suspecting of information communication with their bank. We're also seeing further movement of incidents onto the mobile platform. And when fraud and phishing is moving onto the mobile platform, it's not that phishing people are going to access phishing sites from their mobile phone. Where we think this is really going to go, and there's already some early evidence of that, is fraudsters are going to try to create applications for the Android platform, for the Windows mobile platform, and even potentially for the iPhone platform, and get people to load those applications onto their phone, which then can, in the background, essentially commit fraud and try to steal information and get the phone to publish information. So it's going to be really, really key to have controls on what applications can be loaded onto phones. Apple's already doing a really good job of that. Android's probably playing a little bit behind the curve. Further, we're also seeing just an advance of the technology behind phishing, really adopting what I'll call Web 2.0 technologies, or really collaborative, high-touch customer experience technologies. So in this particular example, there was a phishing site, and the phishing site had links to it essentially saying, do you need help? Are you confused? Do you forget some piece of information? You click on one of those links, and what it actually does is it opens up an instant messaging session, a live chat session, between, in this case, the fraudster and the end user, where the fraudster just poses to be the financial institution. So what that could mean to you within your own organizations is if you are, whether you're using a bank or whether you're developing your own sort of customer-friendly functionality where they may chat with you, that becomes a channel which fraudsters may try to mimic or otherwise exploit so that they can have live communication with end users and steal information from them. So we see that phishing sites continue to evolve, and the sophistication and the capabilities of phishing sites are growing. On the other side, there's malware. I'll use the word malware, Trojans, or crimeware interchangeably, so please bear with me on that one. We see a definite continuing evolution of malware, even though there's lots of forms still out there. The triangle here sort of captures the tier, the pyramid, that we're currently monitoring of malware. From at the bottom, the very widespread, but very low-tech Trojans, moving up the stack in sophistication, even though they may be less widespread. So at the very bottom of the stack here, we have Trojans that we call local farming. Local farming Trojans are really basic. All they do is if you get them on your machine, they have the ability, if you go into a browser and you type in mybusinessbank.com, what the local farming Trojan will do is if it sees you type in mybusinessbank.com, it will redirect you to another site that the fraudster has mocked up, much like a phishing site to probably look like mybusinessbank.com, and try to fool you into providing the information to this fake site. A keylogger is exactly as the name describes. It is a Trojan that gets installed on your machine and basically captures anything that you type for any purposes. It generates a lot of garbage. Fraudster has to do a lot of filtering, but it is overall pretty comprehensive. The next two levels, Form Grabber and HTML Injection, are really where the sophistication and the targeting of a Trojan kicks in. And we've had it in the next slide. I'll give you a little bit further information on this, so I won't belabor it here. And then at the top, the least widespread, but definitely by far the most technically sophisticated, is the man-in-the-browser Trojan. We can have a little bit more information on this to show you, but the man-in-the-browser Trojan is really able to actually intrude in on banking sessions and perform transactions in real time that you don't even know about. High, high level of sophistication here. So as promised, a form grabber and HTML injection Trojan, what are some of the capabilities that it has? So on the left-hand side, you're looking at a screen capture of a bank website that RSA mocked up for our own purposes, and you see that it has a username and password field. Very, very typical fields. Well, a Trojan that can do form grabbing, what it does is it knows that if this was, again, mybusinessbank.com, the Trojan's actually been developed to understand where these username and password fields would be on the web page. So if you, from your PC, go to this site, the Trojan knows to basically execute itself and capture any information that you would type in that username and password field and provide it over to the fraudster. It would not catch the other garbage. It only would zoom in on that specific information. On the right-hand side is the next level up in sophistication, the HTML injection Trojan. Now, the injection Trojan does the form grabber one better. It sees that if you go to mybusinessbank.com, it will execute itself, and not only will it grab the details in the username and password, it will actually add two additional fields locally on your PC in the browser window, asking for whatever information the fraudster desires. So in the example here, we see it asking for ATM number and ATM PIN. This is called HTML injection. It's actually adding content into the web page locally on the PC. So a much higher level of sophistication, and it requires knowledge by the fraudster when they write the Trojan to understand what the mybusinessbank.com web page should look like. And probably the most scary part of all of this, given the cybercrime supply chain we talked about, is all of this functionality and this capability can be acquired just for essentially $350. The Limbo Trojan is a good example of a Trojan that can do this. So individuals with access to those underground forums for the net price of $350 can execute this kind of fraud. And then continuing to work in advance the functionality, real-time Trojan abilities. This is really the man-in-the-browser Trojan. RSA is part of its services monitors underground forms in both Russian and English. What you're looking at here in the background is actually a screen grab of content from a Russian forum, and then our translation is posted in front. And really what this is a discussion of the Zeus Trojan and its ability to do what we call auto-transfer, essentially meaning that if your machine is infected with a Zeus Trojan and you go to a bank website, it has the ability to not only execute on its own transfer, it can send it immediately to a mule or to essentially a man in the middle who can then turn around and launder those funds. So it's very, very automated and very, very sophisticated. The funds can be extracted before you even know it. So we've seen how phishing attacks continue to evolve and continue to grow. And then we're also seeing where Trojans are really growing, how they're growing in sophistication and capabilities. But what these days are the new targets? Of course, there will always be the traditional banking accounts, but where else are fraudsters going? So first of all, we see the fraudsters looking more and more for the big score. They're rebalancing their risk-reward equation, saying, you know what, it's in our interest to try to go after something potentially more interesting. And in this case, a common one that we see now are corporate bank accounts. These are the bank accounts or information about the bank accounts held by any small to medium-sized businesses. Fraudsters now understand that those accounts probably have more funds in them, and not only do they have more funds, they may have more functionality provided to them by the bank. So this is a screen grab here, again, from the underground, where fraudsters are looking for email addresses of a company CEO and top executives. If the fraudster gets this information, what they may turn around and do is launch something that we call a spear phishing attack, a targeted attack to those executives, essentially trying to trick them or social engineering them into providing information about the corporate bank account. Because then if the fraudster can get that information, much higher reward. A lot more work, but much more worthwhile. We see also that fraudsters are starting to turn their attention to some of the other information that they may be sitting on. Trojans capture large amounts of information, not just consumer information. We found when we ran some studies that Trojans capture an incredible amount of enterprise-related information, which is mainly due to the fact that organizations, any organization in any vertical that issues laptops or have mobile users or remote users, those PCs can also become machines themselves that can get infected, particularly once they're disconnected from the corporate network. So RSA ran an analysis of some data that we collect from Trojan drop zones, or the locations where Trojans send stolen information, and we found very significant amounts of email addresses from corporations, evidence of infected machines touching corporate domains. You see here that we talked about, this slide talks about Fortune 500. We only picked that as an effort for our study just to give ourselves, just to narrow down our own study. But the reality is many, many enterprises across many verticals and of many different sizes are losing enterprise information. Now, what's important here is fraudsters to date haven't really known what to do with this, because this doesn't necessarily directly translate into money that you can steal, or you can't buy something on online shopping. But we're expecting that fraudsters are going to begin to realize the information that they're sitting on and start to figure out ways to monetize it. Could be blackmail, could be stock manipulation, but they're going to figure out what to do with this enterprise-related information. Then further, we also see them starting to expand their scope and really go after non-financials. This is probably also born out of the same notion where they start phishing non-financials. But in this case, this fraudster has more than 6,500 health insurance claim records. And they see that within the records, there's interesting information. There's name, social security number, other personal information. And in the same way that they may fish a non-financial site, they realize that this information may have value to another fraudster who could potentially turn it into something else. So now suddenly there's value in going after non-financials to expand and potentially make money. And then finally, sort of as the last item, what we're seeing, and this particularly correlates to the enterprise story, we're seeing that fraudsters are developing new methods of really distributing their malware, invading the enterprise, invading those corporate accounts, and overall trying to greater vectors of penetration. Again, the same notion from social networks. If you were to get an email from someone that you work with, then you're much more likely to trust it, much more likely to click on it, potentially infect your PC. We're seeing that more and more corporate-based distribution is accidentally occurring. So that's definitely an area where fraudsters are going. So we're seeing in all that the attacks themselves continue to evolve, the phishing and Trojan attacks, and the fraudsters have greatly expanded their views of what they're going after and other areas and opportunities that they may have to make money. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and hand it over to Lance Murray and Pat Alcox from Fifth Third.
Thanks, Sean. You know, Sean's presentation paints a very frightening picture of the threats that exist in the Internet world today. And over the last year, the entire banking industry has experienced an increase in the volume of cyber threat attacks on both commercial and retail customers. These customers are being targeted by criminal networks with one goal in mind, and that is to obtain the credentials necessary to initiate fraudulent transactions to an account of their choosing. Now, as you learned in Sean's presentation, this is not your average phishing email asking to help the Nigerian prince or an amateur hacker trying to make a few bucks. These are well-funded criminal organizations with teams of programmers that write highly sophisticated pieces of malware. You learned how this malware makes customers believe that they are at a website or web page created by their financial institution, when in reality they are not. Unbeknownst to the customer, their credentials have been compromised, and before they even know what happened, a fraudulent transaction has been initiated. So Pat and I would like to talk about how you can take proactive steps to team with your financial institution to help protect your organization from being a victim of Internet payment fraud. Financial institutions dedicate a significant amount of resources to ensure that they are able to provide their customers with a safe and secure environment to conduct their banking transactions. The reason for this is simple. Customers trust their bank to protect their money. If that trust is broken, the customer goes to another bank and the deposits and revenue are lost. Therefore, financial institutions go to great lengths to fulfill that commitment to their customer by providing a secure environment. And I'd like to highlight four specific best practices that you as a customer should ensure that your bank has employed. Defense in depth is best described as a multi-layered approach to protecting customer data. It typically includes a tiered network that's protected by firewalls that separates databases from the applications, from the websites, or what the customers see. It begins at the physical layer, the perimeter, makes it increasingly more difficult to get at the data source. Strong authentication has been adopted by basically every financial institution due to federal guidelines that have been established. Most banks have deployed this in the form of two-factor authentication, typically using a token or a one-time password that's randomly generated and possessed by the customer. Banks that allow customers to conduct online payment transactions should proactively monitor transaction behaviors and take action when anomalies or deviations to normal behavior are detected. Typically, banks have deployed this in the form of challenge questions that prompt the customer for answers that only they know. And finally, out-of-band authentication is yet another layer by which a bank can validate that a transaction is legitimate. In this form, the customer will typically receive a phone call and be asked to confirm the attributes of an initiated transaction, like transaction type or the amount or the destination. Without that validation, the transaction will not be released by the financial institution. However, even if your bank does all these things correctly and secures their environment and your information, that's only half of the equation. Your financial institution does not have control over your PC, your organization's control environment, or your behaviors. And as you learned from Sean's presentation, the majority of online fraud today begins with a customer's PC becoming infected with malware. Let's explore ways that you and your organization can take steps to protect your transactions. A recurring theme that you'll hear today is the concept of layers of controls that integrate technology and business processes to make it very difficult for the cyber criminals to be successful in their mission of conducting fraudulent transactions. Clearly, most customers and organizations have implemented antivirus protection. Unfortunately, industry statistics show that antivirus software alone has been less than 50% effective at detecting the most sophisticated pieces of malware that exist today. Therefore, antivirus must be complemented by other technology-based controls, like firewalls, tools that limit the websites that are allowed to be accessed, protection to secure the browser sessions, staying up to date with the latest versions of software, browsers, and tools, and maintaining a solid general technology control environment by utilizing strong passwords. However, technology controls must in turn be complemented by solid business process controls, which Pat will discuss more shortly, but include segregating duties of your administration functions from your payment functions, requiring approval of all payments prior to being released, and education and awareness for your employees, especially those that have the ability to conduct payment transactions. Based on what you've learned today, there are clear actions that you and your organization can take to enhance the level of protection of the internet-based payment transactions that you conduct. It starts with education of you and your employees. While antivirus is not an effective solution by itself, please keep your virus definitions up to date. Instill strong general controls, especially related to passwords, throughout your organization. Add web browser protection to your security tool suite, which I'll expand upon in a minute. Consider dedicating a separate PC that is solely used for conducting payment transactions and not used for internet browsing or email. And finally, use good judgment with the emails that you receive, the websites that you visit, and the methods that you conduct your everyday business over the internet. I'd like to spend a moment talking about a relatively new piece of technology that's available in the market that provides protection at the internet browser level. There are a few different products that are currently available in this space, but one to highlight is Rapport by Trusteer. Basically, Trusteer Rapport puts your internet session in a bubble, prohibiting malware from penetrating that session. It encrypts the keystrokes from being compromised by keystroke logging malware. It helps to ensure that the browser session is pure and blocks main and the browser-based malware, and provides a secure communication connection to the protected website. And by the way, Trusteer Rapport is available for all Fifth Third customers for free, and it's downloadable from our website. With that, I'll turn it over to Pat Alcox, who's going to discuss business process controls and best practices that'll add that additional layer of protection to complement the technology and security controls. Pat?
Great. Thanks, Lance. You know, when I think about protecting your payments, it really, I think, starts with a foundational and good set of business practices that are really established really by you and your company. And it begins with implementing everyday policies and procedures and tools. And I think what's most important about it is that many of these things can be implemented by you today at a low or no cost option. So what are some of the things that we're talking about? Well, as you heard Lance talk about, probably one of the greatest things to do is to establish dual control procedures where you segregate responsibilities between employees who initiate payments and those who approve them. You know, creating such a procedure creates a good set of checks and balances to verify transactions, their dollar amounts, and who to whom the payments are being sent to prior to, and that's the key word, to releasing the payment in the system. Another thing that can be done is separating your accounts, setting up collection accounts versus disbursement accounts, check versus electronic, payroll versus accounts payable. They're all key components to really segregating the transaction amounts in a way that allow you to really go into the next component, which is effectively reconciling your accounts. I recently read an article last week that suggested that almost 26% of business accounts don't reconcile their account statements month to month. So what does that mean to all of you? Well, first and foremost, as with any crime scene, speed is the key to a quick resolution. So providing your bank with prompt notification that can enable them to quickly close your account and prevent further transactions, as well as begin working on with other banks to recover and collect funds, is key to implementation of an effective strategy. Another good business practice is establishing controls around check stock, including things such as placing your stock in a secure area, whether that be a locked room or safe. In addition to that, placing dollar limitations on checks so that you can cap your exposure is another way of doing that. And more importantly, establishing dual control procedures. In other words, in order to execute a check transaction, maybe you need more than one signature on the account in order to execute that check. Lastly, limit the number of signers that you have on a checking account. Particularly given employee change in turnover, it's important that you provide your bank with notification of updates to access to your checking account from a signer perspective. More importantly is being able to remove those individuals who have access not only from a check writing capability, but also those who can access the information via your bank's online banking account system. So how can your bank help you protect your company's assets? Well, one way is through the use of services they offer, such as check or ACH positive pay. So what's check positive pay? Well, check positive pay has been around for a while. It was developed a little over a decade ago, where banks create really the ability for companies to review checks prior to posting, giving companies really the opportunity to review and or approve or reject checks prior to the posting. This type of service can really help all of you save you time, money, and aggravation. Two of the recent capabilities that banks have recently developed to enhance check positive pay are in the area of payee positive pay and teller review. Let's talk a little bit about both of those. Payee positive pay really includes the review of pay information to whom you are writing the check to, in addition to the dollar and check amount. This capability is really to ensure that there's no alteration in the pay information. Teller review is really the integration of the check information into the teller line so that if checks are written, they cannot go to the teller line and cash them. So the integration of the posting and review of decisions to which companies make and integrating them into the check cashing platforms are key to success. ACH positive pay, much like check positive pay, also gives you the ability to review ACH transactions prior to posting. Much like check positive pay, it gives you the ability to review debits and credits prior to posting to, again, provide you the appropriate time to review or reject unauthorized transactions. ACH blocks and filters are also a service that includes the ability for you to set predefined criteria that allows you to identify or block particular transactions based upon the number of characteristics, such as a transaction type. That might include things such as payroll, consumer versus business, debit versus credit, as well as other characteristics such as dollar amount. You may be in a situation where you never submit an ACH transaction greater than $1,000, and as such, if a transaction were to come across that way, you might wish to outsource that and review it to make sure that there was no fraudulent situation. Lastly, you may have a situation in which you do not do business in particular industry. So setting up industry types which would preclude or prevent payments to be either sent and or received in a particular area would be another way of blocking and filtering your ACH transactions. Lastly, looking at the addition or augmentation or inclusion of business credit cards in your payment stream is a key. In lieu of accessing and attempting to secure petty cash on site, you can use a corporate card to make and track purchases, including T&E, corporate purchase, fleet, and things of that nature. This, again, can minimize an employee's time away from work and from the office, and also eliminating the need of securing cash. It also provides a great opportunity for you and management to have greater visibility on the types of transactions that your employees are conducting. And in addition to that, it may fulfill regulatory or audit or policy requirements within your company to ensure that you have an electronic means of tracking the types of transactions that are going across from your employees and your company. So what does all this mean to you and your company? Well, first of all, I would start by saying that there's no silver bullet to preventing payment fraud. And you must use a combination of tactics and strategies and solutions that are first offered by your bank, and secondly, by things that you can do. The things that we talked about from your bank include the things such as transaction scoring, out-of-bank authentication, and back-office analytics. So when you're looking at selecting a financial institution, it's important for you to ask them whether or not they have invested in their backroom operations and their infrastructure with technology such as this that will help protect your company's money. And secondly, what are the things that you can do? Well, again, establishing controls around passwords and not publicly displaying such information in the public, segregating duties and dual control responsibilities, introducing universal technology solutions that protect all layers of your company's technology, from your network down to the application, down to the database, and even to the worktop. So doing things like updating your virus protection, creating firewalls, introducing new technology solutions such as Trustee are all things that you can do to really assist in mitigating payment fraud. And last and probably most important is attending sessions that helps you better understand what's happening in the industry and how to change or augment your policies and procedures to better combat payment fraud. So with that said, what I'd like to do now is turn this back over to Roland Prevost, who will provide some closing comments. Roland?
Okay, thank you very much. And I'd like to ask Pat Alcox if he's got any closing comments he'd like to make.
Thank you, Roland. Again, just to reiterate it, you know, what's important to note is that what's unique about happening in the industry today is that the criminals are always attempting to do things uniquely and differently. So what you hear today likely could change tomorrow. But what's important is that all of us continue to work together to identify situations that may be perceived as suspicious, and to work together to better understand how we can help you mitigate those solutions. So with that being said, again, should you happen to find yourself in a situation such as that, you know, listening to suggestions and recommendations that you've heard from Lance and Sean with respect to that, I think are important key components to helping mitigate that.
Fifth Third Bank is pleased to bring you the preceding podcast. For more information on Fifth Third Bank and our solutions, visit our website at 53.com/commercial.